Hello and welcome to Independent Thinking, the weekly podcast from Chatham House. I'm Bronwyn Maddox, the director. This week, we are returning to Russia's war against Ukraine, and we're asking the question of whether a new US package of aid will enable Ukraine to hold on this year. Over the last few months, there's been a growing sense that the momentum has switched to Putin and his military campaign after Ukraine's astonishing first year of defiance against the Russian invasion, but then a year when it failed to break through and to repel Russian forces. And then this year has seen Ukraine somewhat on the back foot. February brought the harrowing retreat by its forces from Avdiivka, and now the world is seeing Russian missiles, drones and artillery pound the cities of Kharkiv, Chernihiv and Odessa. And on the front lines, Russia is believed to have a 5-1 artillery advantage against Ukrainian forces. So it has been feeling pretty bleak for Ukraine, and Russia's new confidence that it has the upper hand has been strengthened, of course, by the delay in US support for Ukraine. For 6 months, $61 billion in military aid for Ukraine and Taiwan and Israel, as they were originally part of the same bill, has been stuck in the US Congress as some Republican members sought to link that aid with measures connected to migration across the US-Mexico border. And then on Tuesday, we had a breakthrough as the US House and Senate finally authorised the bill. In the UK, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak also announced an extra £500 million for Ukraine to go alongside the EU's €50 billion agreed in February. But even with this new money, the question is still whether Ukraine can hold on until all this arrives and whether all this spending will then have an impact. So I have three people who immerse themselves in these questions to discuss all this. Returning to the podcast is Oz Kataji, a journalist and filmmaker who's covered Ukraine extensively and has a documentary out soon on the battle for Kyiv. Welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me, Bronwyn.
Great to have you here. Joining us from St. Andrews is Professor Phillips P. O'Brien, who writes and comments regularly on Ukraine and US strategy towards Russia. Welcome, Phil. May I call you Phil?
Phil's fine, Bronwyn.
Great. And finally back on the podcast this week is Ukrainian journalist Olga Takariuk, Academy Fellow here at Chatham House. Great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Very, very good too. Looking forward to this. Well, let's dive right in. Phil, I want to start with you. Is this year when Ukraine might lose this war?
Well, not now, I would say, since the ammunition is going to start flowing again. And by the way, the cutoff in U.S. aid, yes, began around January 1st, but the U.S. had also been decreasing aid very significantly in the last few months of 2023. So Ukraine has received very little from the U.S. over the previous 6 months, and almost nothing since January 1st. And that was defining the war, that Ukraine's largest supplier of weapons, by far, the U.S. supplies more than any other country, much of Ukraine's ammunition had basically gone AWOL. And had that continued for the rest of the year, the Ukrainian armed forces would have been in very serious position. They would have had to get by with the kind of ammunition that the Czechs were trying to scrounge for them around the world. So that has defined the last few months. That ammunition will now start flowing. By the way, it had been prepared. It had been put aside. It was on the pallets. It was ready to go.
The Pentagon has big bundles of this with a big ribbon around it, ready to go.
Ready to go. And it's already started flowing. With that flowing, it's very, I think, possible, more than possible, very likely that the Ukrainians are going to stop the Russian advances relatively soon. Because advancing in this war is really hard. If we've learned anything at looking at this war for the past 2 years, moving forward for either side is incredibly bloody and incredibly difficult because of the advantages of defensive firepower. Those advantages will now swing to Ukraine with the ammunition flowing. So it could have been really desperate had Congress not stepped up and done this. Hopefully with this aid and its flowing, Ukraine can stabilize the line.
All right. Well, that starts us off in quite an optimistic note. I just want to be clear, when you say that the ammunition and the kit had gone AWOL, you mean that foreign allies had not supplied it, not that it's gone missing.
The U.S. had gone AWOL.
But not that this stuff on the ground has gone missing.
No, that the U.S. had gone AWOL as a supplier.
All right, well, we're going to come back to that point that you've just raised about what difference this particular aid is going to make in detail. But I just want to catch more of the feeling of where we are in Ukraine right now. Oz, what can you tell us about the situation on the ground?
Well, look, it's bad. And I'd go further than what Phillips had said by talking about the fact that Viktor Orban managed to successfully block the 50 billion European aid package to Ukraine.
This is the Hungarian leader. Yeah.
And that made things bad. And, you know, it's been a collection of these things happening over the same time period. And while it's true that the US aid was slow, it was really slow because Biden lost control of the House. And when that happened, basically aid packages stopped. You know, when the Democrats controlled both houses, aid was flowing quite freely in 2022. As soon as he lost that, the aid basically dried up immediately.
So what has been the effect on the ground? You've been reporting quite a lot on this.
Yes. So I was with an embedded with an artillery crew in the east of the country at the end of March, and the situation there was beyond critical. I was seeing bodies being pulled off the front lines. I know that they were being killed at really short range. So because the Ukrainians don't have the ammunition to conduct things like counter-battery artillery fire, the guys told me that they've stabilized those front lines, but they've had to do it by throwing men into the meat grinder in order to be able to stabilize those front lines. So when Ukraine lacks the ammunition to fight back, they have to stabilize using manpower. And that's terrifying. It's terrifying for Ukraine. The situation, the ammunition-wise, is so bad. The artillery crew that I was with have a front line of 20 kilometers. For that 20 kilometers, they have 9 functioning artillery pieces. For those 9 functioning artillery pieces over 20 kilometers, they had 90 shells. 90. That was it. There was nothing coming in. There had been nothing arriving for months. So they had this 90 shells, and they were rationing that 90 shells across 20 kilometers of front. When I asked them, how could they hold these positions with this much ammunition? They said, we cannot hold our positions with this much ammunition. If the Russians push hard enough, we have to retreat.
Which is the front line you're talking about here?
So look, I don't want to give the exact position. It was on the eastern front line somewhere in Donbass. And I don't want to give the exact salient because it'll, yeah.
That's absolutely fine. And obviously what you've described, I mean, Ukraine seeing a generation of its young and middle-aged men killed in this way is devastating for the country and for its confidence, and doesn't make it easier to recruit new people into the army or to conscript them. Olga, what is the significance of this Russian focus on attacking the cities? And we've seen it really going for some of the biggest cities in Ukraine. What damage has that done, and what is Ukraine feeling about this?
So yeah, as Oz said, Russia is not just pushing on the battlefield, on the front lines, but also attacking with its missiles and drones Ukrainian civilians and critical infrastructure. So the biggest target is arguably the city of Kharkiv, which is on the Russian border. It's the second largest city in Ukraine with more than 1 million people, and it's under constant daily bombardment by Russia. Civilians are killed there daily. And in the last several weeks, basically, Kharkiv was also grappling with a shortage of electricity. So people only have electricity supply there for several hours per day. It has, of course, a huge impact on the quality of life of people there who are still trying to leave there, you know, who are not abandoning the city or who have been returning there from other parts of Ukraine or from abroad. And another part of this Russian strategy of making Ukraine unlivable with these aerial attacks, exploiting that Ukraine did not have enough air defense before this aid package was voted, is to target Ukrainian critical infrastructure, in particular energy grid. So this, in recent weeks, Russian attacks caused more damage to Ukrainian energy grid than those in the winter of 2022 and 2023. They completely destroyed the biggest thermal power plant in Kyiv region just in the beginning of this month. You know, this has a huge impact on Ukrainian resilience, Ukrainian survival as a functioning state that is able and capable of providing basic services to its citizens. And of course, it has a huge impact on the intentions of civilians. Do they want to stay? Can they afford to remain in Ukraine, or will they be looking at prospects of leaving and becoming a new wave of Ukrainian refugees abroad?
Refugees and exiles, in a way, it's one of the points we keep coming back to. And I've talked to Ukrainian politicians about this, that so many people have left Ukraine. Let's call it about 8 million. And many of them, you know, have children, may have met new partners or something, may not want to easily to go back to Ukraine. Obviously, others will be longing to go back to Ukraine.
Security is a major precondition, you know. Yeah. Until it is not safe, people are not willing to return, and all efforts to lure them back will encounter this major hurdle. They need to feel it is safe to bring their children back.
So, Phil, let's go back to the picture that you were painting in the beginning of, against this bleak picture that Oz and Olga have described about the position on the in the battle, or the position in the cities. Now in comes the American aid and some bits of European aid as well. Do you feel confident that this can change the tide of what is happening? Just call it over the next 6 months or so till the American election.
Stabilize, I think, is what it can do. I mean, again, it's affected everything. We're talking about the attacks on the cities. They ramped up an effective. This was by far the most effective period the Russians have had on that. And that's because the Ukrainians didn't have any anti-air ammunition. So they were able to hit targets by overwhelming the Ukrainian ability to fire back because Ukraine had such limited ammunition supplies. And they've done a lot of damage. I mean, the last few months have done a lot of damage to Ukrainian infrastructure that did not have to happen. And making up for that will certainly take time and a great deal of effort. But yes, I do believe the line can be stable. I mean, we have, Oz is reporting, and there's been this reporting about what the experience in the front line has been terrible. And the Russian firepower advantage has been 5, 10 to 1, maybe more in different times.
It's 20 to 1 in the place where I was at times. That's what they said.
21, and Russian advances were 5, 10 kilometers. You know, so we have to put the ability, I mean, we have the story of war. And the story of war is the sort of the massive firepower advantage and all of that. But if you look at the process of war, what the Russians were able to do with that massive firepower advantage was, to this point, still somewhat limited.
All right. And so just for the American aid now comes in. What do you think Ukraine might be able to do with this over this summer?
Defend. I mean, Ukraine's not going to attack. But I mean, simply that's not on the cards. But what it will allow them to do is defend with much greater firepower than they have had to this point. And if the Russians keep the same tactics, which have, by the way, been costing them a great deal. Yes, Ukrainian casualties have been high, but Russian casualties have been extremely high in the last few months. What this will do is reduce Ukrainian casualties because they'll have defensive firepower and raise Russian casualties. So it will change the trends of what's been going on in the fighting if the ammunition gets there. So one would think that if it gets there in the high quantities, that actually it will improve the Ukrainian fighting position significantly, as long as Ukraine doesn't do anything stupid like attack. Nothing like the counteroffensive. Stand back, reduce Ukrainian casualties, raise Russian.
Nothing like the counteroffensive that it planned last year, which didn't come to as much as it hoped. Oz, what do you think of this? What will it do to Ukrainian actual fighting ability and morale? Because these have been devastating months, as we've all been discussing.
Yeah, and look, in my experience, the morale issue was intrinsically entwined with the ammunition issue. The morale isn't low because the men lack the will to fight or are afraid of fighting the Russian army. The morale is lower than it has been because they don't have the means to defend themselves, which is a really awful position to be in for a soldier. You know, the message that I've got from the commanding officers is, look, morale is still as high as it ever has been. These men are committed. They believe in their fight. They're defending their homes. That's something the Russians do not have, but they're unable to do so right now because they don't have the means with which to defend themselves.
And not just unable, but their main supporter so far has gone wobbly, to coin a phrase.
Yeah.
Has said it's in various ways, it's not so sure it's committed to this.
And look, we're probably going to this amount of aid that's coming through from various different places, not just the US, is probably going to be enough to see Ukraine through the rest of 2024 comfortably. The years beyond that, Trump presidency potential, are a different question. I'm sure we'll get onto that. But right now, I concur with what Phillips was saying, that I don't think there's going to be any kind of offensive this year, despite what Zelensky has said in public. The Ukrainian army doesn't have the current capacity to go on the offensive. However, And I do want to say this is not a I'm not in the business of making predictions. I'm not a fortune teller. The losses that Russia has been sustaining are staggering. It's not just high; it's insane. There's no way to make sense of them when you look at the numbers of material and men they've lost in the last few weeks going up against these Ukrainian positions. As criticized as Ukraine's counteroffensive was last year, there was nothing like this.
So what are the kind of numbers you've heard about Russian losses?
We're getting dozens of tanks lost and armoured vehicles lost a day and has been for stretching back to the beginning of the winter. So I think there is every opportunity for Ukraine to break the back of the Russian army in Ukraine this year. Russia has finite resources in artillery, in manpower, in equipment. It seems functionally infinite to the Ukrainian men who've been defending their positions for the last 2 years. But we have to bear in mind there is a finite resource there, and Russia is desperate to get this war won as quickly as they can.
I'm going to come back to a couple of those points, and we are indeed going to talk about the impact on Russia. But Olga, where is the support for President Zelensky now in Ukraine? What are people feeling about his leadership and all the many things he has said about the conduct of the war?
Well, obviously, the support is not as high as it was at the very beginning of the war when it hit 80% and above, but it is still quite high. It is in around 60%, which is a quite high percentage. It's not about the political leadership. And people in Ukraine, generally, they also understand that the political leadership cannot change. There can be no elections held when the martial law is enforced and when Russia keeps bombing Ukrainian cities and civilian targets. It's just simply not safe to hold elections. So people accept that, yes, this government is in power, will be in power in the foreseeable future. But the question here is not, you know, as much the support for the government, but the understanding that there is a much bigger enemy, there is a much bigger threat, and the unity is needed. And somehow citizens, they have to also align with the government to demonstrate that unity, to be able to remain resilient, to fight efficiently, to fend off a Russian aggression. So although the support is not as high, it is still significant. Ukraine is still fairly united, although there have been cracks appearing that Russia tried to exploit as well with its disinformation campaigns, with various influence operations in Ukraine. But I would say that Ukrainian resilience is still high. And just coming back to the point of, you know, what difference will this US package make? I just want to mention that we've seen already the reactions from the battlefield, the soldiers, Ukrainian soldiers making thank you videos to America, thanking for this aid package. And also Ukrainian MPs, they displayed American flags in the parliament. So it has been like really well received, very much welcome, long overdue. There is a feeling of relief, but there is also a feeling that it's not over yet. Of course, this aid will make a difference, especially the new long-range missiles, ATACMS, that might be able to target Crimea. That might be a really important development in the war. But more needs to be done. And here, Europeans can also step in and do more.
Absolutely. We're coming on to exactly those points. But you've mentioned the thing I was going to ask the three of you, specifically about the long-range missiles. Do you think Ukraine will use them to hit targets inside Russia or Crimea, which Russia controls? And some people have said, look, this is going to escalate things if Ukraine starts doing that. The three of you, in any combination or order, what do you think?
I've been talking a lot about this. I mean, the administration, by the way, if you're talking about the long-range ATACMS in particular, has once again stated, and they stated yesterday, Jake Sullivan openly, that the U.S. will not have these used in Russia.
Jake Sullivan is the U.S. National Security Advisor.
What the U.S. has said is that U.S. weapons cannot and will be used in Russia, and we assume the Ukrainians will follow that. But the big thing is they can now be used in Crimea. I mean, what is going to be used in Russia is going to be Ukrainian homemade systems. And that's what they have been using, is Ukrainian homemade systems. And by the way, Ukraine supporters can help build these, but they're not going to be Western-made systems because no one wants a way. The Germans are absolutely, that's why they won't give Taurus even to be used in Crimea, because the Germans don't want a German missile to attack inside Russia. So, but what will change is that Crimea, which has always been something the U.S. in particular has not wanted Ukraine to have the ability to attack, that is now attackable. I mean, that's what the ATACMS will do. So they will allow the Ukrainians to really, the one great success, we talk about the battlefield, And that's been not going well for Ukraine. But the Range campaign has been a Ukrainian success around Crimea, and it's been a success for over a year.
Keeping access to the sea open has been its huge, huge success.
I mean, that's a major strategic victory. And this allows them to start pressing the Russians even more on Crimea.
Doing what precisely on Crimea?
Well, Crimea has been a base, sort of a safe base for Russia for certain things, primarily anti-air forces. So they've been able to have these anti-air equipment throughout Crimea that Ukraine could only really hit with Ukrainian UAVs or Storm Shadows and Scalps, finally. And that means Russian aircraft have been protected and Ukrainian aircraft have had to stay away. Now, the first attack from the ATACMS that we know about was an attack on Russian anti-air forces in Crimea, a very devastating attack if the Ukrainians are correct. What that means is the Russians will either have to devote enormous amount of resources to protecting the forces in Crimea, or they'll have to pull them back. And if they pull them back, that means Russian aircraft are far more vulnerable. And by the way, Ukrainian F-16s, when they appear, will have greater range to go forward.
All right. So even though you and Oz were very much talking before about Ukraine just trying to hold things in place over the summer, not going on the offensive, in a way, what you're describing now is offensive. It's trying to do something very, very deliberate in Crimea to weaken Russia's foothold in Crimea.
Yeah, it's a strategic air offensive, air and sea. It won't be the army attacking.
Right.
That's not what we're going to see. We're not going to see the army attacking. But Ukraine has been on a strategic offensive the entire time in the Black Sea.
Oz, you're nodding at this.
Yeah, look, I want to bring up the kind of diplomatic discussions between Kyiv and Washington. Jake Sullivan, Kamala Harris have been talking to the Ukrainian government, trying to convince them, please don't attack oil facilities inside Russia. You know, we're skeptical about giving you these long-range missiles because these messages have not gone down well in Kyiv at all.
And just explain why they're saying that.
I mean, look, these could be for many reasons. Some of the reporting has suggested that the oil prices going into the election is something that the Biden administration wants to keep down, and attacking Russian oil facilities drives that cost further up. As you mentioned earlier, the escalatory spiral. As I said, Jake Sullivan has been the lead on trying to stop Ukraine from doing these attacks. And Ukraine's response has been to do more attacks. So, you know, there's kind of some of the discussions about Ukraine seem to talk about Ukraine as a country with no agency that just does what its patrons tell it to do. That's not the case. Ukraine is a very active participant in this. I really agree with Phillips. I think there's going to be large-scale attacks inside Russian-controlled territory and potentially inside Russia. I don't think these ATACMS are going to change something like the Crimean bridge situation. I don't think the ATACMS are the right weapons to take down a hard target like a bridge. The Storm Shadow Scout missiles, Taurus missiles would be better for that, in fact. So I think we are moving to a place where these will eventually start making their way to big Ukrainian attacks. What they do is they give Ukraine a capacity to attack further than they have had before. So Ukraine will use these responsibly, I think, personally.
By the Crimean bridge situation, you mean the Russia's bridge to Crimea and its access to Crimea?
That's correct. Yeah. They want to bring it down.
But have not yet. So let's roll all this on to November, the American presidential election. Let's assume that the American presidential election gets decided quite quickly. It has not always been the case. And Olga, what is the impact on Ukraine? We've all been discussing, and I've taken some reassurance in what the three of you have said, that this package of aid really makes quite a difference, that Ukraine can therefore hold on, plus a little bit more, over this summer. So we arrive in November. What difference does it make to Ukraine if Trump or Joe Biden, if those are the two candidates, we still have to say, what difference does it make? Which one wins?
Well, of course, there are fears that if Donald Trump is reelected as the U.S. president, there might be less support to Ukraine. But arguably, that not necessarily has to happen. You know, we've seen with this aid package that was passed, we've seen a U-turn, basically, from the position of the Speaker Johnson, who decided to put it on the vote, and it went through. There was a conversation between him and Donald Trump that preceded that. So there are still months to go till the elections. And I think what can be a factor in changing his position could be really understanding what is at stake, understanding that the U.S. national security interests can be affected really heavily and undermined by a possible Russian victory.
Okay, so Trump, if he's the candidate, he might be persuaded. that contrary to what he said about reaching a deal with Putin in a day and stuff, that actually that might not be the US's best
interest. We shouldn't be too gloomy still. You know, there is still time to go. It might go either way. But definitely, Ukraine and Ukraine's partners in Europe need to prepare for the eventuality that the US aid package might not be renewed. There might be no more US aid coming in. And there is still time to prepare for that. Europeans could and should do more. They are already making some plans and discussing possibilities how to raise, how to get more funding to increase their own defense production, how to make funding for Ukraine more sustainable and so on.
So let's come on to that question, Phil. What do you think Europe has been doing as it has contemplated the possible absence, maybe for a long time, of American aid?
Not enough. I mean, to build on Olga, I think we have to be pessimistic. I think, and I've been talking with a lot of Republicans in the last few weeks about this to try and understand, Trump did not endorse this aid package for Ukraine. He just didn't stop it, and he didn't stop it because he believes that he needs to get all Republican votes to win the presidency. And that means Nikki Haley, pro-Ukrainian Republicans. So this is a short-term tactic. What Trump will almost certainly do if he is elected is two. He will say the war must end, Ukraine must give up the Donbass and Crimea and the front line, and if Ukraine refuses to accept my peace terms, no new aid. And I think if we're expecting anything else, we're living in a dangerously optimistic world that I wouldn't be. Trump doesn't want Ukraine to do well in this war, and he's very comfortable that Putin does, and he does not actually support Ukraine aid now.
Just explain to us, Phil, why, because you made a very strong statement there, that Trump actually doesn't want Ukraine to do well in this. Why, in your view?
He believes the Ukrainians were pro-Biden, and he is very comfortable with Putin. His wing of the Republican Party is basically a pro-Russian, pro-Putin wing of the Republican Party.
And that is something new that we have heard increasingly, some of them seeming to soak up some of the propaganda that Russia has been putting out about both Ukraine and Russia. So just on this question of European support for Ukraine.
Well, Europe has to be very serious now. We have thankfully received this aid, which will really help for the next 9 or 10 months. But there is a very real chance that after 9 or 10 months, we're back to the same world we were in. Now, hopefully, both Europe and Ukraine will prepare for that world better. The Ukrainians and the Europeans were not expecting a January 1st cutoff. The situation that would be faced in January 2025, if that were to happen, can be ameliorated if steps are taken now. The Europeans can never replace the U.S. That's not a question of replacing the U.S. It can't do it, and it can't do it within 9 months. However, it could start putting into place ammunition production, systems production, UAV support for Ukraine, a whole range of things. So if the U.S. goes, it's not the panic-stricken situation that it was before, but it's a better situation. Intellectually, that's understood. I'm not sure if materially it is.
And so, Oz, what do you make of the debates in both France and Germany, two of the key European countries? France's President Macron saying, even talking about European boots on the ground in Ukraine, but Germany having a really profound debate internally about what kind of support it will give. And really, the idea of, say, German forces taking on Russian forces within Europe in the wider sense would be, to many, many people in Germany, absolute anathema.
So look, I should show my cards here and say that I very much am a hawk on this subject, and I have been a hawk on this subject for many years. And I think that not confronting Russia has resulted in all of this. At every point that Russia has escalated and gone further, the West has had opportunities to make that response more costly for Russia and has chosen not to do so. So, you know, Macron is enjoying his more hawkish moment now that he's no longer seeking re-election. And Scholz is hamstrung by God knows what it is personally that's holding him back.
Scholz being the German chancellor, and there's obviously a lot of agonizing within Germany about its relations with Russia, its relations with China, even Israel.
That's correct. So look, the point is that putting troops on the ground, we have to be very clear with this. It's often discussed as this completely unacceptable escalation. British troops have been on the ground since the war began. There have been British military advisors helping the Ukrainians since the start of the war. They've been here. It's an open secret that they're here. And I don't think that the French and the Germans, if they were to follow suit, would be a huge escalation.
Right. And so we need to be clear, by boots, we are talking in that old tradition of military advisors rather than...
I'm going to specify here. I could think of things that could go a lot further. I think that Western troops could man positions across the Belarusian border and allow the Ukrainian soldiers to focus all of their efforts on the front line they share with Russia. Because at the moment, Ukraine still has to dedicate resources across the northern border in parts that are not currently facing any kind of invasion threat. But doing that takes away resources from the border that matters the most in this current phase of the conflict. So I think there is room and scope for Western troops to be able to do this. And the reason I say this, and I need to stress this, is I'm not just trying to drive some sort of escalation. If Ukraine loses this war, this is a catastrophe for Europe, and it is as guaranteed that there's going to be a major war between NATO and Russia immediately following suit. Russia will go further. If Russia believes it's fighting the entire collective West, if it defeats the entire collective West in Ukraine, that's the message it will take.
And quite a few people within Chatham House who would share your view. Sorry, yeah, Olga, you might be one of them.
You think just, a major takeaway from all this, the US aid package and the discussion that we had, is that actually much of what is in this aid package could have been delivered back in 2022, and, major
correct
losses would have been prevented. Yeah. So many things that Ukraine asked for, like Atacms, it has been asking for since 2022.
We understand that. And this is the picture of the aid has come later than Ukraine asked.
And another point is
that... But we are where we are now.
Yeah, and another point is that, the cost of all this, it might seem big now, but I think it is still smaller than it could be if Ukraine is defeated, if Russia wins in Ukraine.
So both of you made a powerful case for why Europe should do more at this point. Phil?
I actually had an article out on this in Foreign Affairs 2 days ago with two co-authors talking about how European troops could go into Ukraine and how they could make a difference, and without actually going to the front line and going directly into combat. That I think people have looked at this in often the wrong way, of European troops running into direct combat with Russia. They could do a whole host of operations which would free up a large number of Ukrainian personnel and provide really valuable support. And it would be in Europe's interest to do this. It's interesting. Yes, people are still hesitating, but the debate is a lot farther along this road than it was 6 months from now.
Yeah, it's interesting what you're saying, that it isn't just words then, in a sense, from President Macron. So let me ask you all one final thing. Let's move it on still to November. Ukraine has held on, maybe done a bit more than that in Crimea, and not Trump has won the presidential election. Can any of you see terms or circumstances in which Vladimir Putin would pause or settle or back off?
Well, Putin will back off when he is forced to, when he has to, when he faces the force and the strength that is overwhelming. And we've seen, the previous fears of escalation, let's not deliver Ukraine this type of weapons, or let's not do this because that will provoke an escalation. They didn't materialize.
Right. So they haven't. Let's deal with the reality of the support that we're looking at now. I absolutely understand the pitch that you and Oz have both made for why Europe should do this. I happen to agree with you that this is hugely important for Europe's future security. But let's deal with what we've got. Can you see circumstances in which Putin is persuaded to back off, that he is convinced that he is losing a lot and cannot win?
Well, if he doesn't have the resources needed to continue this war in terms of manpower, in terms of money, and here is an important point, Russia still has a lot of money. There is still a lot that could be done to deprive Russia of that money. And if Russia faces several significant defeats on the battlefield.
Oz.
For me, Putin has the same sort of mentality that Hitler has. I know people think that's an exaggeration, but I don't. Hitler carried on fighting until he blew his brains out in his bunker. Putin will keep going. He will not stop. And this is what people need to understand. Putin is a 20th century fascist dictator. He only understands the language of violence, and only violence will bring his reign to an end. I do not think that there's going to be a massive war that destroys Putin's regime. But I do think the only way this ends is if every last Russian troop is pushed across that border. No deal that's signed with Putin that freezes any conflict line is worth the paper that it's written on.
I understand that point, but just on your previous one, do you think it is likely, given what we're looking at now, that what you've just described of every Russian troop being pushed back across that border, all land given back, is that likely?
Likelihood is a very difficult thing to say because there's too many factors involved that could change that. I think that if the West continues to hold firm and support Ukraine for as long as necessary, Ukraine can win this war. The trajectory can go in Ukraine's favor, but only as long as that aid holds, which is why the Trump presidency is such a threat to Ukraine's victory in this war. So I do think there's a potential for Ukrainian victory, even after all of this loss that Ukraine has suffered. But that requires basically a permanent outsourcing of Ukraine's wartime economy to the West. It needs that lifeline to survive. I think it can survive with that, but this, we're entering a serious period of jeopardy for Ukraine politically, and Ukraine needs to be preparing for disaster. I don't think a Trump presidency is the final curtain for Ukraine. Ukraine can survive four more years of a Trump presidency and get some more aid after that. But I do think trying to freeze these lines will only benefit Russia. And that's why I think that the only solution to this war is a total Ukrainian victory.
Thanks for that. I do generally discourage comparisons with Hitler, but you've made your point. Phil?
I have no idea on Putin. I mean, I'm not a Putin expert or a Russian expert, so I don't want to guess. But certainly the Russian army, if the Ukrainians, if properly armed, can push this Russian army back. That's what I look at. Putin can want to win the war, but a lot of war leaders want to win a war and then they don't win it. So, I mean, to me, it's not so much what Putin wants. We all want many things, but that isn't always what happens. What we need to do is understand that if Ukraine is going to win the war, by winning, I mean liberating its legally recognized territory, it needs to be armed in a very strong way to undertake certain tasks. And if Ukraine is helped to be armed in that way to do those tasks, then really what Putin wants is not the big question. So I think in many ways we're making Putin the controller of Ukraine, whereas we as Ukraine's allies have just as much influence on this war as Putin.
Yes, but at some point, to bring this to a close in the kind of way you're discussing, Putin would have to agree with himself that it was not worth fighting more.
But who knows? I mean, maybe he decides his own life is more important, or maybe someone goes, I mean, I don't want to guess on that. I would just want to say militarily, Ukraine can be aided to get the Russian army out, and it should be.
Well, thank you all for that. We've taken it through with actually more confidence of a kind through at least to November. And you've all just begun to say at the end, it was very interesting saying Ukraine could hang on through a Trump presidency. And we haven't really got into this in this discussion of what is happening in the US generally about its views about being active overseas in this kind of war. All that for another time. But thank you for a conversation that was more confident on Ukraine's side than I had expected going into it. With that, though, we're going to have to stop for the moment. So a huge thank you to my guests, Phillips P. O'Brien, Oz Kadaji, and Olga Tokariuk. Do follow them all on X or Twitter. Their details are in the show notes. And a reminder that you can find all of our podcasts on Apple, Spotify, all major platforms, as well as on our social media. So please do like, follow, subscribe, and leave us a review. It does make a difference to us. And to read more from all of our experts or to find out more about our events or our great Russia and Eurasia program, don't forget to visit chathamhouse.org. All our work and liveliness is on there. So in these two hectic times, it's goodbye from me, Bronwyn Maddox, until next week.